News. I'm Tommy McNeil. U.S. and North Korean officials held a meeting at a non-proliferation conference held in Moscow. A former U.S. official who attended the conference told VOA's Korean service, as the denuclearization talks between Pyongyang and Washington remain deadlocked at this time. U.S. officials, led by Mark Lambert, director of the Office of Korean Affairs at the State Department, attended that three-day annual Moscow Non-Proliferation News Conference. Chol Isu, head of the North Korean Foreign Ministry's North American Department, led the delegation from Pyongyang. On a day of public testimony and impeachment, witnesses say that President Trump asked about Ukraine investigations. AP's Ed Donahue.
William Taylor is the top diplomat in Ukraine. He testified there were discussions about U.S. aid and investigations of Joe Biden.
A member of my staff could hear President Trump on the phone asking Ambassador Sondland about the investigations.
Gordon Sondland is another diplomat. That staff member asked him what President Trump thought about Ukraine.
Mr. Sondland responded that President Trump cares more about the investigations of Biden.
This was after President Trump's July phone call with the new leader of Ukraine that set off the impeachment inquiry. Ranking Republican Devin Nunes says nothing bad happened.
Security assistance was provided to Ukraine without the Ukrainians having done any of the things they were supposedly being blackmailed to do.
An anonymous whistleblower's complaint set off the inquiry, and Republicans want to hear from that person in a closed hearing. Ed Donahue, Washington.
The political crisis in Bolivia. We're rolling a street protest amid accusations of election fraud forced the resignation of longtime President Evo Morales earlier this week. It's exposing long-held differences within Russia's own political system, with pro-Kremlin and opposition voices splitting along familiar dividing lines. This is VOA News. There's no indication of any breakthrough following talks Wednesday between the leaders of Turkey and the United States at a time their relationship is at a low ebb. More from Jennifer King.
While impeachment hearings were underway on Capitol Hill, President Trump hosted Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his wife at the White House.
I'm a big fan of the president.
And he seemed determined not to let the hearings or the recent incursion into northern Syria get in the way of good relations with the NATO ally.
We're having a very strong discussion on different things, including the safe zone and the border, the oil, and again, trade is a very big factor.
A handful of GOP senators invited to the Oval Office expressed their concerns about the fate of Kurdish allies and Turkey's warming relations with Russia, including the purchase of a Russian air defense system. Among them was Texas Senator Ted Cruz.
We very much hope Turkey changes the path it's on and does not employ the S-400.
Trump says he thinks their differences can be resolved. Jennifer King, Washington.
Pro-democracy protesters, a number of them students, barricaded themselves at universities in Hong Kong as the schools become the latest flashpoints in the demonstration's quest for a greater autonomy from China. Violent confrontations between authorities and demonstrators continue to erupt. Sabrina Schatz is a exchange student at Hong Kong Baptist University.
It was surreal. Like, look at my surrounding. I just, like, 4 days ago I walked down here to a supermarket and right now it's a battlefield. Yeah, it's crazy.
In an attempt to quell street protests this week, police entered the Chinese University of Hong Kong, Polytechnic University, and the University of Hong Kong, lobbing tear gas inside the first two institutions that touched off fights at several schools. Israeli aircraft struck Islamic Jihad targets throughout Gaza Strip in the early hours Thursday. While the militant group rained scores of rockets into Israel for a second straight day, the death toll rose to 32 Palestinians, including six members of one family. The UN's Mideast envoy rushed to Cairo to work with Egyptian mediators on arranging some type of truce. The fighting erupted Tuesday after Israel killed a senior commander in the Islamic Jihad militant group, Baha Abu El Atta, along with his wife as they slept in their Gaza home. A 17-year-old male in the state of Michigan is said to be the first person in the United States to receive a bilateral lung transplant for vaping-related injuries. The boy's severe injuries include extreme lung inflammation, scarring, and dead tissue, and they alarm medical professionals, especially given the patient's age. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Daily Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbate in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 14th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan's SPLM-IO reacts to U.S. criticism about the lack of progress in the peace implementation.
Instead of just blaming the parties, the United States, the TRICA, and the UN need to participate practically in the implementation process by providing support, resources, and critical evaluation of the process.
The European Union Council pledges 55 million euros to Sudan's new transitional government. African migrants say they are enjoying their new life in Rwanda. A Liberian journalist wins an International Press Freedom Award. And Rwanda explains the shooting deaths of two Ugandans accused of smuggling.
When police officers tried to stop the smugglers, they refused and eventually, violently, they had wanted even to kill the police officers. So what happened in self-defense, of course, police shot dead two of them.
David Claudien Mushabe is the mayor of Rwanda's Nyagatare district, and a new study examines the impact of power blackouts on doing business in Nigeria. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. An official of South Sudan's opposition SPLM-IO, led by Riek Machar, says the United States needs to participate fully in the implementation of the revitalized peace agreement by providing necessary resources and critical evaluation instead of just blaming the parties. Stephen Park Cole, SPLM-IO Secretary for Foreign Affairs, was reacting to U.S. State Department warning Wednesday that the United States will reevaluate its relationship with South Sudan after President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar failed to form a transitional national unity government. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo says the U.S. will work bilaterally and with the international community to take action against all those impeding South Sudan's peace process. Stephen Park Cole says the United States appears to be ignorant about what is being done to implement the peace agreement.
First of all, this balance backing does not help peace process in South Sudan. We are implementing an agreement. And what the United States government needs to do is to evaluate the agreement itself before evaluating its bilateral relations with South Sudan. First of all, the United States government refused to sign this agreement as one of the guarantors. And look at what they are saying, which is also against the traditional norm of diplomatic relations. We as a liberation movement do not have bilateral relations with the United States. So this is an affair between Juba and Washington. So what is it that is being said here that the United States will reevaluate bilateral relation with South Sudan? South Sudan has a government, one government, under President Salva Kiir, and it is here represented in Washington, D.C. by the embassy of the Republic of South Sudan. Where does the SPLM-IO come in?
While that may be true, that the SPLM-IO may not have diplomatic relations with United States, yet your leader, Dr. Riek Machar, signed the peace agreement. And so far, he has failed to keep his part of the agreement.
That is not true. We have done our part. And the problem with the United States is that the United States is intentionally ignorant of what is being done to implement the agreement. Otherwise, it would know what the SPLM-IO and the SPLM-IO leadership has done to make sure that this agreement is implemented.
The Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, says that the failure of your leader, Dr. Riek Machar, and President Salva Kiir to form this government calls into question their suitability to continue to lead South Sudan. Do you think your leader, Dr. Riek Machar, is suitable to be a leader?
Yes, Dr. Riek Machar has been playing leadership roles until this point in time. And these things that you need Riek Machar and Salva Kiir out of the system is also misplaced, because Riek Machar has no regime in South Sudan is running now. There is only the government of the day responsible for the resources, responsible for diplomatic, bilateral diplomatic relation between the United States and South Sudan.
You are in Washington. Do you plan to meet with U.S. government officials, for example, from the State Department?
No, we have not met anybody yet here. But if we get the opportunity to meet one, we will explain to them and we will urge them actually to participate in the peace implementation process and takes correct observation of what is happening instead of bashing both parties and speak of this language like double regime change or something like that. It doesn't help at this time. Our leadership in the Sudan need support from the Western government, especially the United States, to implement this agreement and account each party individually, saying that all our leaders have done this together or have failed to do this together is not helping us. We are parties, and not only the SPLM-IO and the SPLM and the government, there are also other parties that have signed this agreement. And the United States, the TRICA, and the UN, instead of just blaming the parties, need to participate practically in the implementation process by providing support, resources, and critical evaluation of the process.
Stephen Parkour is the SPLM-IO Secretary for Foreign Affairs. He was speaking with us from Washington, D.C. The European Union Council has pledged 55 million euros to the new transitional government in Sudan. Sudan's prime minister says the donation will be used to provide humanitarian assistance to families affected by years of fighting in some parts of Sudan, where aid agencies could not access in the past due to restrictions imposed by the former government of Omar al-Bashir. Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
Federica Mogherini, the European Union's representative for foreign affairs and security policy, says the donation will help Sudanese people in war zones. Mogherini made the announcement shortly before meeting with the Sudanese Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok on Monday in Brussels. Mogherini says the EU is optimistic about the way political changes will be handled in Sudan, adding that her office will collaborate with the new leadership of the transitional government.
We just announced an additional financial support for humanitarian aid, and we exchanged with the Prime Minister on the most pressing needs on which the European Union is going to accompany the civilian democratic transition of the country. We always tackle crises that seem impossible to be solved, and in this case we have a good story that could represent not only success in itself, but also an inspiration for the rest of the region.
Mogherini says the EU will continue to offer political and economic support to Sudan. Speaking in Arabic to Euronews TV channel in Brussels on Tuesday, Hamdok described the meeting with EU officials as fruitful and says he will continue to discuss reforms of the Sudanese public institutions and how to achieve lasting peace in Sudan.
Our interactions with EU officials gave us a chance to present priorities of our transitional government. We presented our views on silencing the guns and building lasting and sustainable peace. We briefed them on our economical situation and what EU can offer to support us to overcome the challenges.
And with Sudan's new leadership, Hamdok appealed to the EU officials to help remove Sudan's name from the list of countries sponsoring terrorism.
We need a policy that would maintain good neighboring interests without any interference. We would like to make sure that our Sudanese women are fairly represented in our transitional government.
Mohamed Abdulaziz, a Sudanese journalist who has covered Sudan's economy situation for 10 years, says the EU donation is crucial for providing food and medical support to people living in war zones, including Darfur, the Nuba Mountains, and the Blue Nile regions.
This is an additional support which will push relief some economic challenges that are linked to humanitarian situations. The EU has been supporting Sudan in some fields with more than 200 million euros. Now, this can help in sorting some humanitarian challenges after achieving lasting peace in the country.
Many Sudanese are hopeful Prime Minister Hamdok will use his external connections to help rebuild Sudan's economy after years of economic hyperinflation. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, November 14. Daybreak Africa time is 15 minutes past the hour. Security authorities in Ugandan districts bordering Rwanda have banned traders from unnecessarily traveling into Rwanda through unguarded border crossings. This follows an incident on Sunday when Rwandan defense forces near the border fired on five Ugandans, killing two. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
Since the Rwanda-Uganda border was closed 10 months ago, border communities on both sides have devised ways to trade over unguarded border crossings. Life had gone on normally until the killings on Sunday, which have sparked fear among residents in the border communities. Rwanda's government says the people its forces shot at on Sunday were illegally smuggling tobacco across the border. Uganda this week placed security officers on the border on high alert to arrest any Ugandan trying to sneak goods into Rwanda to prevent new clashes with Rwandan security forces. Prekeria Muhindo Mwine is the Ruchiga resident district commissioner and is in charge of security in the district.
You know, smuggling is a criminal offense in Uganda, so we are going to emphasize that law. We are going to waken up our police officers at the border. If they see anybody smuggling anything across the border to Rwanda, they should have him arrested so that he's prosecuted. Otherwise, if you want to take anything to Rwanda, let them use the official borders.
Strained relations between Uganda and Rwanda led to the border closure. Rwanda also has barred its nationals from crossing into Uganda, accusing its neighbor of jailing Rwandans and holding them incommunicado. While Ugandan authorities view the shootings as the result of the tense relationship, Rwanda's government says the two were killed after they tried to violently resist security forces during arrest. David Claudian Mushabe is the mayor of Nyagatare district in Rwanda. He was among the officials who returned the bodies of the Ugandan nationals.
When police officers tried to stop the smugglers, they refused, and eventually, violently, they had wanted even to kill the police officers. So what happened, in self-defense, of course, police shot dead two of them. Besides that, to me, I can say it is very unfortunate, though there is a lesson to learn. They should not be violent, those who smuggle, and also they should know that there are some gazetted areas that they should be using when they are going for businesses.
But Muhindo protests the shooting.
And I want to condemn the killing. People should be arrested and put to prison. Killings don't solve problems. Let us maintain the relationship which has been between Uganda and Rwanda, because we are actually neighbors, we are even relatives.
In a protest note to Kigali, Ugandan authorities say the alleged crime does not justify shoot at unarmed civilians residing along the border. Uganda has called for a joint investigation of the killings to bring the perpetrators to justice. About 2 weeks ago, a Rwandan national was shot and severely wounded on Rwandan territory while bringing potatoes from Uganda. A second meeting on reopening the border, it has been pushed to November 18th, but no reason has been given. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
More than 180 African migrants and asylum seekers who were transferred from Libya to Rwanda say they are enjoying a new life of freedom. Eugene Uimana visited the Gashora Transit Center where the migrants are staying and filed this report.
It is an afternoon in the Gashora Transit Center where the Rwandan government offers migrants and refugees lodgings and support. A group of young migrants play volleyball, trying to leave miserable memories behind. This person says they are happy in Rwanda. They have all their basic needs met, and they are thankful to God that they are all alive. The transit center is equipped with dormitories, playgrounds, health facilities, and sanitation. The migrants say they enjoy the facilities, but still vividly remember the hardships they experienced in detention in Libya. When they recall, they shed tears. This woman says they lived a very miserable life in Libya. Her brother was killed before her eyes. The teacher says there was more abuse. She cannot just say it to reporters. Over the past several years, tens of thousands of people from Africa and the Middle East have traveled to Libya, hoping to go from there to Europe. And in agreement with the European government, Libyan authorities detain those they find to wait transport to their home countries or third nations. In the past few months, Rwanda has begun accepting migrants from Libya in a program coordinated with the United Nations. Migrants say at the Libyan detention facilities, people were beaten and killed. These migrants say they found no safety in Libya. Clementine Aunquete is the UN Refugee Agency Regional Director for the Eastern and Great Lakes region.
We are extremely grateful to the government of Rwanda and the AU, who are partners with UNHCR in this endeavor, for, number one, their leadership in coming forward and providing these people with a sanctuary, a place to have their basic needs met.
UNHCR officials say there are many options for the migrants, including resettlement to the third country. To date, Guam has taken in 189 migrants from Libya. This month, about 120 more expected to arrive, and nearly 200 more will arrive sometime after that. Ejene Uwimana for VOA News, Bujesera, Eastern Rwanda.
Liberian journalist Rodney Sear, editor and publisher of Front Page Africa newspaper, says journalists around the world are today undergoing immense suffering for writing about the ills of society and about the about those languaging at the bottom of the economic ladder. Sear spoke this week after being awarded the X International Press Freedom Prize at the University of Malaga in Spain. Sear says he hopes the award will help arouse the attention of the world to the dangers that journalists face each day in doing their job.
Well, James, I think it's a validation of the work we've been doing all these years, investigative reporting, in-depth analysis, digging under the corridors of government to make sure that they're accountable, that they are transparent to the people of Liberia. And I think it validates our work we've been doing. It is a vindication of everything that we've been fighting for all these years.
Yet you say that the jailing of journalists is becoming more and more familiar globally. Why that in the context of Africa?
If you look around Africa these days, James, you see what's happening in Burundi. We have four journalists that were picked up. They're still languishing in jail. You look at Cameroon, the situation there. Journalists are living under fear. You look at Uganda. You look at what happened in Ghana earlier this year with the killing of Ahmed Hussein. And all those things that have been happening, it tells you that journalists are at risk and there's no protection for journalists around the continent of Africa because corrupt leadership and rulers tend to rule like they have no fear for journalists.
You are from Liberia, and whenever we speak to officials of the Liberian government, they say that the current government promotes press freedom, freedom of expression. And so talk to the listeners in Africa in terms of the level of press freedom and investigative journalism in Liberia as you live it every day and experience it.
Well, James, it's one thing to say there's press freedom, and it's another thing to actually practice press freedom. As we speak now, you're aware that the Roots FM owned by Henry Costa is off the air. The judge that ruled that the government was wrong to shut him down was removed from the case. You also know that the issue of Patrick Hunter from Punch FM, he registered his station, he was given a license, and the government revoked it. And since then, it's been more than a year now, Patrick Hunter is not on the radio. So all of these things, if you calculate them, it tells you that we still have a long way to go in Liberia. There's still issues to be addressed that need to be addressed. And if we don't address those issues, I'm afraid that we'll continue to have problems for the media.
Of course, Rodney, when you speak to the Liberian government official, particularly the Minister of Information, he says that the issue of Roots FM and the Henry Costa show, which airs on that radio station, that show promotes violence. I'm just saying that's what the government thinks about this particular radio station.
In the same vein, Jing, there's another station that also does the same thing, but they do it in favor of the government, and that station is still on the air. And I think it's a double-edged sword that the government is treading. I think they need to be consistent in how they address these issues. You cannot cite one station for something while another station is doing the same thing and you let them go and punish one station. I don't think it's a fair thing to do.
That was Rodney Sear, editor and publisher of Liberia's Front Page Africa newspaper. With its educated workforce, large youth population, and boundless energy, Nigeria is a natural home for Africa's tech entrepreneurs. However, a new study by the Center for Global Development says regular blackouts deprive these startups of the electricity they need to operate securely and effectively. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Vijaya Ramachandra, a senior fellow at the center and co-author of the report.
The purpose of the study was to try to understand what the challenges and opportunities are for tech entrepreneurs in Nigeria. Nigeria has an enormous pool of tech talent, and Nigeria has a very large young population who are engaged in starting up technology firms. So it is a vibrant tech sector filled with lots of enthusiasm.
First, what is meant by the terms tech entrepreneur and tech entrepreneurship that the study and report use so often?
We considered quite a broad definition of tech entrepreneurship, essentially people who are using computers and digital platforms to carry out business, people who are in e-commerce, in retail, in digital payments platforms, in providing advisory services online, app developers. It includes people providing cloud-based services. So it's quite a broad definition.
Whom did you survey for this study and what did you ask them?
We surveyed 93 tech entrepreneurs, and they listed a number of obstacles, including lack of access to finance, the high cost of broadband. But the one they cited the most was the lack of access to a reliable supply of electricity. Often they experienced a power outage at least once a day, and the power outages tended to last sometimes several hours. That meant they lost work that they had not yet saved, or they had to stop working, or they suffered in terms of losing business. So it really is a major constraint.
Of course, that lack of reliability can take an emotional toll as well as a financial one.
You're right that, you know, losing work is very upsetting. And for young people starting out, there's not a lot of room for losses and for these kinds of disruptions. So really, it comes down to providing them with the very basics of a good business environment.
Do you think that the situation has a negative impact on foreign investors who might want to put in some of their money into some of these tech inventions and startups?
We did not interview investors outside of the country, but certainly, you know, for investors who are looking for good places to invest across Africa, you want to have a basic level of services. So I think for investors, this must be frustrating to know that, you know, there is this power problem. At the same time, you have this very talented pool. I think if we can fix the power problem, the number of jobs available for young Nigerians in the tech sector would probably increase.
Vijaya Ramachandra is the senior fellow at the Center for Global Development. She spoke with viewers Adam Phillips. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. An official of South Sudan's opposition SPLMIO, led by Riek Machar, says the United States needs to participate fully in the implementation of the revitalized peace agreement by providing the necessary resources and critical evaluation instead of just blaming the parties. Stephen Parr Cole, the SPLMA's Secretary for Foreign Affairs, was reacting to U.S. State Department warning on Wednesday that the United States will reevaluate its relationship with South Sudan after President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar failed to form a transitional national unity government. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said the U.S. will work bilaterally and with the international community to take action against all those impeding South Sudan's peace process. And that's it for this Thursday, November 14th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the fall of the Berlin Wall 30 years ago marked the end of the Cold War and brought about a number of significant changes in Africa. We'll take a closer look on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bonga flavor to sukus, Afrobeat and dumbolo and makosa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.